Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, belongs to you, it's not a bank, and you don't have to live in Baltimore to be part of it. And you can also go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information will be right there. And let me welcome David Kennedy to our show today. David Kennedy is director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control, a professor of criminal justice, the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, co-chair of the National Network for Safe Communities, and he's been doing this work for a long time. His book that chronicles this work is what we're talking about today. It's Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. And David Kennedy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's nice to be talking to you again, Mark.
It's great to be talking to you again. I read with sad relish the chapter on Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk about this concept, first of all. Because take us back to Boston ceasefire. Before we get there, take us back even further. Because you've been involved in this work a long time. Part of what I learned in this book that I didn't know, that when you first started out, I believe in graduate school, you were sent off to Watts. Right?
I wasn't even in graduate school. I was a lowly staff writer for the faculty at the Kennedy School of Government in Harvard. I've never gone back to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us what happened in your journey to Watts.
I wanted to be a writer. So I was a couple of years out of college. This was the very early 1980s. I wanted to work for The New Yorker. And I had a very clear plan for getting to something like that kind of a place. I was doing a lot of freelance magazine work, mostly science writing kind of stuff, and you can't live on that. And I got a wonderful day job writing what are called teaching cases at the Kennedy School. So the Kennedy School is a school of government. It's not a political science department. It's designed for people who want to do work in and around government. And as a professional school, like a business school, it does a lot of its teaching by the case method. And it had a little shop called the Case Program that would take assignments from the faculty and go off and write these teaching cases. And it, in a weird way, it was like writing for The New Yorker. Not that anybody read our stuff in the same way, but you got time to work. They sent you around the country. You got wonderful access to folks. You call them up and say, I'm from Harvard and I'd like to interview, and nearly everybody says yes. And I was working on defense procurement and strategic studies and intelligence analysis and all kinds of stuff that was just part of the general work of the school. And after a couple of years of this, I got tapped by what turned out to be a really standout group that had its center of gravity at the Kennedy School, but really involved some of the best criminal justice thinkers from around not only the country but the world. And they were beginning a multi-year project that looked at what they thought was the bankruptcy of the then standard approaches in American policing. They sent me off to do some of the field research, most of the field research as it turned out, in some of the most innovative police departments in the United States. And because this was the mid-80s, what a lot of those departments were focused on was what was then the beginning of the 10-year crack epidemic. And so what in practice that field research and writing meant was that I traveled the country walking crack markets and looking at what these departments were trying to do about them. And that's what got me into places in neighborhoods that otherwise I never would have gotten anywhere near.
And I and the work you've done is, I mean, I remember when we first met each other and when you came to Baltimore, I guess it was the late 90s, right?
That's right.
But you came here because of what happened in Boston.
Yep.
And what you did in Boston, what you did with others in Boston.
And that's the way it's usually talked about, and that's true. But by the time we were invited to come work in Baltimore, Boston had expanded to a small number of other cities where the same basic approaches had also turned out to be dramatically effective against homicide and shooting. So there was a small but extremely promising track record at that point.
And let's talk about that. Because you were talking about Boston was the city you began, but you also went to Stockton, a much smaller city, and other parts of the country where this worked. But let's talk about what it was that worked. Because this is, it's almost, it's because one of the things you said that blows people's minds all the time is we know how to stop, end the killing, and it's simple. We just have to do it.
That's correct.
And that is?
Tell them to stop.
Now, that does sound simple, David.
It's completely idiotic, right? And you know, just like that, it is idiotic, except it's also essentially the truth. So here's what we first saw in Boston, and which has now turned out to be true all over the country. And because folks who are focused on Baltimore often look at Baltimore and say, nothing that worked in those other places can possibly work here because Baltimore has such a serious street problem. Let's begin by saying that we set up in the worst neighborhood in Chicago just over a year ago. And Chicago and Baltimore and their worst places are on a par. And for the first time in about 10 years, the neighborhood in which we're working in Chicago is not the most dangerous neighborhood in Chicago, because in the year and a bit that we've been working there, homicide's down 40%. Right, so the book says, and it was time to write the book, because it is now true that we know how to do this and this stuff works. And I'm getting a certain amount of flack as I travel the country and people review the book, because people just can't believe that's true. But it is. And here's how it works. So if you go to the cities that are dealing with homicide and you know, high levels of community despair about violence and gunshots, and also about the chaos that comes with public drug dealing, then you find always the same thing on the ground, which is that a dramatically small population is driving that. You know, we talk about young men, we talk about young black men because, well, nobody likes to admit this, the worst of this is in historically distressed African-American neighborhoods. We talk about at-risk kids, we talk about people with criminal records and all that kind of thing. That widens the net so dramatically that you can't see what's really going on. And what is really going on is that a incredibly concentrated street population, typically under 0.5% of the population citywide, is connected with 60, 70, 75% of all the killing as victims and offenders. And they are standout folks. You can identify them. We did identify them in 1999 in Baltimore, and as bad as Baltimore was at the time, it was only about 4,500 core players citywide. They averaged 10 and 12 prior arrests apiece. They were connected with 70, 80% of the killing. Baltimore is no different. And that means that you can engage with those folks in a very specific way. And the most important thing is to engage with them as they present themselves on the street and in the neighborhoods, which is in groups. This is a group dynamic, whether we call them gangs or sets or posses or neighborhood networks, which was the language we used in Baltimore. It doesn't matter. They are groups. They are being driven by group dynamics. They are feuding with each other as groups, and we have to engage with them as groups. So that means, and almost all of this is set up. I'm getting to the work now, and it doesn't take very long to describe.
Mm-hmm.
The groups have people on probation and parole. They are just so active that that's virtually always true. That means you can get probation and parole to bring members of the groups to a meeting as a condition of their supervision. And in the meeting, they see the assembled forces of law enforcement, police, prosecutors, probation, parole, FBI, DEA, ATF, everybody. They see social service providers who can help them, and they see members of the community that they respect, the elders on the block, the mothers of murdered children, the older, wiser ex-offenders, those sorts of folks. And that partnership says to them, thank you for coming. You're going to be going home. We want you to carry what you hear today back to your groups on the street, because things are going to be different from now on. The violence is going to stop. Your community needs it to stop. Your community needs you alive and out of prison. Your community embraces you, but it rejects a couple of core things that you're doing, and your community needs those things to stop.
We're going to take a short break, and I'm going to come right pick up where we left off here, because this is really important at the place we're in with this story with David Kennedy about what didn't happen in Baltimore, could happen in Baltimore, what's happened around the country, about how we can stop the violence, save our communities and children, and begin rebuilding. This is a very important tale that got lost here. We're reopening it today. But first, we have to come back and talk about RWEA, which is one of the few places you can hear this kind of conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with David M. Kennedy. His book, Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America. And David, I think that there was a quote in your book that there are a lot of quotes in your book, especially when you hear the voices of the young men, when you create this program with the churches, with the communities, with the police, with the state's attorney, with people who are ex-gang members who are working in ceasefire kind of programs, with the people who bring these young men in en masse to kind of lay down the law and say, we're not going to allow this shooting and killing anymore. The response by the young men from the street, some of the things you've written about are just mind-blowing in their simplicity, you know, and what they say in response. Like one thing, what hit me in the head once was they shoot because the law don't work.
Never has in my neighborhood, never will, is the rest of that quote.
Right. Yep,
that's right. So that, in various forms, is consistently what you get from the guys caught up in this. And they are caught up in it. They don't vote for it. They don't choose it. They don't decide when they're kids that they want to be locked up and dead by the time they're 25. What they all say is, it is fantastically dangerous out here, and nobody's protecting us. And when you tell me to put my gun down, what I say to you is, somebody out there is trying to kill me, and what are you going to do about that? And we don't normally have a good answer for that.
So then, I mean, what makes... All right, so, you know, when you get up there, and people, I remember, saw one of these meetings in Baltimore... and you say, we know who you are, we know you're doing these killings, there's no use in denying it, just say, and we are offering you now instead a different way, a job, a new way of life, a program to get out of the streets. But, you know, as you write in your book, prison is not doesn't mean anything to many young men. So, you know, it's a way to get off the street. It's not, you know, people, when someone's after to blow you away, saying we're going to put you in jail doesn't do much.
That's actually not right. And the book doesn't say that these guys don't care about prison. It says they will tell you to your face
that they don't,
that
care,
they don't
about
care
prison.
About prison.
Right, right.
And the mistake we make is that we believe them. So I said a moment ago that this is group stuff.
Right.
The group dynamic, the street code, the honor culture that a lot of these guys live by has some very core, but you know, unwritten but extremely real rules. If you are disrespected, you have to get your face back by hurting the person who disrespected you. The enemy of my friend is my enemy. So if I'm beefing if one of my friends is beefing with your boys, then I'm beefing, and now we've got a group-on-group vendetta. I'm going to be dead by the time I'm 25, so nothing matters, and I can do jail standing on my head. You get them alone, and they turn into completely different people. You know, alone, they're smart and interesting and observant, and I almost always really like them.
Mm-hmm.
Out on the corner with their boys drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning, they will scare you to death. And the group dynamic is just different. And when they say, I don't care about prison, they are saying it because that's what they think all of their friends believe. No sane human being wants to go to prison, and almost none of these guys are sociopaths. But part of what it means to be real, to be a man on these streets, is to act like that's true. And what we need to do is give them and give their groups an honorable and safe way to back out of this toxic mess that they're trapped in. And that's what the don't shoot strategies do.
And so to talk about a little bit about what happens at those meetings and what takes place that fulfills what you just said.
Yeah. So I'm sorry this took so long before the break. This stuff is not simple. You know, it's not zero
no.
tolerance or a jobs program or one of those bumper stickers.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got now this room full of essentially representatives of the street groups. Their community has said, if you don't understand how much we hate this, we're going to fix that, and we're going to tell you that in no uncertain terms. The social service providers say, here's the number you call if you want help getting off the street. We will do everything we possibly can for you. And the cops say, despite what you think of us, we want you to listen to these other people. We want you to live. We want you to thrive. We don't want to have to lock you up, but this is not a negotiation. And go back to your groups and tell them that from now on, the worst group in the city and the next group in the city that puts a body on the ground is where we're going to be focusing all of our attention. And we're going to call you back in 2 or 3 months and explain to you that the people who've called have gotten help, that the community still wants you to stop, and that the next group that killed somebody and the most violent group in the city have been dismantled by local, state, and federal law enforcement. And what happens is that when the groups believe that all that's true, that the community they've misunderstood needs this to stop, that there really is a way out if people will take it, and that the price that the groups will pay for violence is that the group is going to be sanctioned. Right? The killer may go to prison for the killing, but everybody else is going to get picked up on, you know, undercover street drug charges. It lets them say to each other, don't do that, the price is too high. Look what happened to those other guys. And besides, our community doesn't like this. It gives them what we started to call an honorable exit. And a lot of them will take it.
I think that I must read you something here that just came across the emails. I think it's important for people to get a sense of this. And this is, again, what I remember when you were here over 10 years ago. Hathaway Ferriby, who was mentioned in your book, just wrote in.
Love and respect, yep.
Wrote and said, hey, Mark, David did great work in Baltimore, and the strategy absolutely worked. Its name in the city was Operations Safe Neighborhoods. Shootings plummeted in the city, and Operations Safe Neighborhoods didn't have a chance to reach its full potential because zero tolerance supplanted it. Please tell David I said hello.
Hey, Hathaway.
But that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, jumping back to our city here for a moment, I mean, I remember it. I remember the frustration that you lived through. I remember the frustration people lived through trying to make this work. It was just utter madness. So, I mean, tell a bit of that story again. We started off with the show with that.
Well, Baltimore has historically exceptionally fractured relationships between its law enforcement agencies. I work all over the country, and I've never to this day seen anything like it. And it's got a particularly aggressive political culture. I mean, all politics are bare-knuckled, But I've never been any place where when politicians and agency heads have issues with each other, they communicate by calling the Baltimore Sun, so it's in the headlines the next morning. And Operation Safe Neighborhoods was really a casualty of all that. I think many in the city were not convinced that it would work, and I understood that. I was pretty sure that it would, that we could make it work, but I understand the skepticism. But it was also really seen as a zero-sum game amongst the key agencies, and each agency really didn't want to see any of the others getting credit for making big headway on the killing in Baltimore. And that competition and friction and internecine warfare killed it. Just as simple as that. We got as far as going live in Park Heights in very early 2000. And as proof of concept, Park Heights got dramatically better for a while. Hathaway will remember, because we've talked about it recently, residents in Park Heights after that first call and walking around saying, "What happened? It's different here." And that tells us, as the Chicago and other work, you know, now tells us that it would have worked, and it never got the running room that it needed to realize that promise.
It's almost as if here and in other communities that we just don't believe it. We think that these kids are sociopaths. Government thinks that that there's only one way to do it, and that's mass arrest and locking them up. I mean, as you write about in this book, I mean, you write this whole piece in this book that is this kind of eloquent plea about incarcerating young black men.
Yep.
And what it's done to society.
It has and is destroying their neighborhoods. So a few years back, the Justice Policy Institute did a study in Baltimore that showed that of the black men aged 20 to 30, as I recall, half of them at any given moment are under criminal justice supervision, right? So that's not to say they've got a criminal record. It means every day, half of young black men in Baltimore are in prison, in jail, on parole, or on probation. And those who are concentrated in the hotspot neighborhoods. Their neighborhoods are damaged. Those are people who will never get good jobs. They hit 30 and they calm down, and nobody will give them a chance. They get married less. Their kids fail at dramatically elevated rates. Their kids get kicked out of school. Their kids are left behind when they go to prison. And when you add into that the kind of zero-tolerance policing that Baltimore favored for a while, it means that not only they, but their families and loved ones and people who really aren't doing much or anything wrong are stopped and stopped and stopped and stopped and arrested and processed. And then we look at these communities and say, well, they're not functioning very well. What's wrong with them? It's obscene.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back with David Kennedy, because we have to continue this conversation. I think that if you read this book and hear this conversation, maybe we can be the force that brings this back to Baltimore. Stay with us. We'll be right back with David Kennedy. Don't Shoot One Man, A Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America. And we're going to come back to talk to you about what we can do here at WEA to make these kind of conversations remain on the air. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're here with David Kennedy. Don't Shoot One Man, A Street Fellowship, The End of Violence in Inner City America. And he means it and he talks about it. And David, you know, I was thinking about the chapter you wrote, Stopping It, in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I, when I read your stuff, I mean, it's so beautifully written in terms of its plea. I mean, when you talk about, in that chapter, Salinas, California, the email you got from Kelly McMillan, the deputy chief, in that community. I just, and you're just saying in this thing, it it can work. It's not a foolproof system. It's not perfect. It's a work in progress. We're trying to make it better. We can see how to make it better. But there are big new developments coming. But right now, today, it works.
Yep.
I mean, you really are pleading to America in this book to say, listen, we can get our way. We can find, this is a piece of our way out of this.
Yep, we can do this. And for your listeners, the note from the deputy chief of police in Salinas. Salinas is a gang battleground in central coastal California. It's a town of only about 130,000 people. It often has the highest homicide rate in the city of California, and it's entirely a product of Norteño Sereno gang beefs. And they started this work over a year ago, and the note from Kelly McMillan was homicides cut in half almost instantly.
Let's stop there for a minute. I mean, all right, again, I think it's important to iterate and to reiterate. I mean, stopped in half. So
yep.
Tell us, and you were there, you worked with them. Tell us the story of Salinas.
Well, the fantastic thing is I wasn't there. I didn't do this one. And since we began, there has grown a vibrant national community of people who get this and are committed to it. They are amazing people from law enforcement and communities and service providers and churches and ex-offender ranks. There really is something close to a movement growing around this. And the Salinas work was done, so the state of California committed to this. There are about 10 cities across the state that are being helped through the process by no more than 3 people. They are running themselves ragged, but 3 people who get this stuff are helping all of those cities get up and going and how to understand it and how to own it. And they are part of something called the National Network for Safe Communities. So those of you who are interested in this, go to www.nnscommunities. That's National Network Safe Communities, nnscommunities.org. And it's all there. The research, the how-to guides, the stories, the innovations, the contacts. We are there to help. And Salinas did this with the help of some folks in California who get it, and it is working like a charm for them.
I mean, I when I said you were there, because I was thinking about what you wrote in the chat before, that you were in Raleigh, North Carolina, and,
yep.
and the High Point neighborhood in North Carolina,
yep.
which you went to. And there's a piece in here, if I can find it, that just, you can feel it as you write about what's his name, if I recall, Chet in High Point?
Yes.
When he spoke to the young gangbangers in that room when they brought them all into High Point in North Carolina.
Yep.
That to me, I'm going to try to find the quote right now because it just summed it up with the way he spoke with those young people.
It does. Yep.
But this is the Chets repeat themselves across the country in this program.
So Chet Hodgins in High Point was a minister in the West End. And, Mark, if you can find it.
I'll find it. I have it. It's in one of my many marks in the book. I will find it as you
can. All of it. And he had been working in the West End, which was a devastated open-air drug market area. The city had been arresting everybody. The city had been running programs. The churches had been doing programs. Nothing had worked. And it was so bad that in my friend Jim Summey's Baptist church there, his parishioners couldn't get into the church on Sunday because there were so many outsiders curb crawling for drugs and hookers. His parishioners couldn't make the turn into the church parking lot. And we worked with them. We put this together. They had their, as we call them, the call-in of the drug dealers in that area, only about a dozen of them were actually driving everything there. And that was May 2004, and that drug market disappeared that day. It never came back. The community pretty much owns public safety in that area now. The cops back them up when they need to. It is transformed.
I did find the quote, and let me read it to our listeners so we can get a sense of what you're writing and also what you what you're saying here. This is what Chet Hodgson said. My name is Chet Hodgson, and I'm with the High Point Community Against Violence. I'm an advocate for crime victims in this area. I can't emphasize enough that this could very well be the most important day of your life to date. So listen and listen close, because we all mean exactly what we're saying. When we get through here, we'll go down and hear what law enforcement has to say to you. But the reason we have brought you in tonight is you have been selling dope in your neighborhood, and we're tired of it, and we're not going to put up with it anymore. You all had your pictures taken. You all had buys made from you. There's no question about what you're doing, so don't anybody say it wasn't me. Yes, it was you. But what we're here for tonight is to get you to turn your life around. You need to find something else to do to make a living. And you think about what you need that we can offer you. Do you need a job? One of the dealers was staring at the table in front of him, slumped down, unmoving. When Hodgson said that, he sat up, came to life, twisted around, and looked at Chet. Yes, he said. There was a chorus of yes from the other dealers, from the mothers and grandmothers. Yes. Well, you come to the right place, Chet said. We can help you find jobs. We work with a lot of companies that are willing to hire you. We won't start off as vice president, but you'll have an honest job. And when this is over, I want you to make appointments with our resource coordinator, Delilah Summers. She's the main one on this. You need a place to live? We'll try to convince your realtor friends, our realtor friends, to rent you an apartment or a room or a house. And one of the drug dealers said, that's what I want, out of the neighborhood. I mean, it's so real.
Yep.
And it's right there.
It's so common sense. It's so basic. And it's so kind of simple and direct that people think it can't work. You know, they think we need to lock everybody up. We have to fix the neighborhoods. We have to fix the economy. We have to get rid of the drugs. We have to do all these things that, in fact, we cannot, as a practical matter, do. But we can do this. And as you said a few minutes ago, it's not everything, but it is a giant, giant step forward for the neighborhoods.
And how did it, given the world we're in now, this post-economic downturn, how has it worked? Because it must be harder and harder to kind of for communities and even cities to kind of keep up to the pledge of helping people find jobs and get out.
Well, what we're finding is exactly the opposite, and it's very interesting. So these issues get next to no federal attention at this point, which is wrong, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
At the local and state level, they get an enormous amount of attention. People are being torn apart by these problems all across the country. And what mayors and city managers and governors and state legislators know is that we are throwing an astonishing amount of money at this problem, and everybody knows it doesn't work.
Right.
Everybody knows it. And when there was money to burn, people could kind of indulge themselves, but now there isn't, and it's making them much, much more realistic. And this actually doesn't cost very much. You don't need new money to do this work. You need to be honest about the resources you've got and how you're going to use them. Stop doing things that many times not only don't work, but actually do damage in the neighborhoods, like a lot of our law enforcement work. And just redirect it to this stuff. It's not a resource question. It's a getting it and a will question.
And it is that. And I think that, I mean, I think what this has to do in at least some communities, and talk about how it might have worked in different places, is in some ways in Baltimore for it to come back, I think it have to bubble from the bottom. People have to demand it to come back. But this, for the most part, and if I'm wrong about this, correct me, but for the most part, this has happened because at the top, the police and others have wanted to happen, or is it mostly happened for you from the bottom up? Talk about how this has occurred.
It's happened in both directions. So one of the things that was quite wonderful about what nearly came to pass in Baltimore was that it really did come from the community advocates. The impetus came from the Safe and Sound campaign and others sort of allied with Safe and Sound, Hathaway's community, that did their due diligence. They looked around. They said, this has tremendous promise. Let's do it. And as we know, they were not fully able to get the attention of the powers that were in the city. We are seeing now, because it's been some time since all that. And the record has evolved, and people's experience has evolved, and the formal social science literature has evolved. We are seeing increasingly beleaguered communities saying to their political leadership, basically, what do you mean you don't want to do this? Our kids are dying. Our young men are getting arrested. The stuff you're pushing on us doesn't work. We demand this. And that is actually how it's come to a number of the California cities.
Mm-hmm.
A network of community advocates has deliberately gone to their political leadership and say, "You, not doing this is immoral." And then you get it coming in the other direction as well. So you get the chiefs and the mayors who say, "Now we've done our due diligence, and we're going to make sure this happens." When those things meet in the middle, it's kind of perfect.
When you talk about how you think you need this, needs to be tweaked, how it needs, not tweaked is the wrong word, but how it needs to grow.
Yep.
Talk about those ideas that you have,
so
what you're learning.
The two big things that have developed tremendously since Project Safe Neighborhoods in Baltimore is our understanding of the power of the community voice, what we call the moral voice of the community, the figures of standing in the eyes of the street guys saying to them, there's right, there's wrong, we embrace you, we reject the violence. You know, if you're going to hustle, find a way to hustle that doesn't tear the guts out of the community. You need to be part of the community. And that has the most amazing voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So we're much, much more respectful of that and much more effective about making that practical. And the other is something that makes people extremely uncomfortable, which is the way in which this has become racialized between law enforcement and especially the most troubled black communities. So anybody who read the first chapter of Peter Moskos' book, Cop in the Hood,
yes,
which is about being a police officer, patrol officer in Baltimore, the first chapter is a screed of quotes from his fellow officers about what they think of the neighborhoods they were policing. And it adds up to they're corrupt, they're hopeless, nobody lives right, nobody raises their kids right, everybody's living off drug money. That's really what they believe, and it's not true. Now, if you actually know the neighborhoods, it is not even remotely true. But when the cops think that, it's a disaster. And then you walk the neighborhoods, and a dominant view in many places is not only do the cops not keep us safe, but the cops are actually behind what's going on. The CIA and the police are bringing the drugs in and distributing them in the neighborhoods, and everybody's getting arrested because that's the point, right? That is how the power is now damaging us, as they have always historically under color of law. And that's why the community doesn't say crisply and clearly, we don't want this stuff going on here, because they don't want to stand with what they view as an oppressive, racist, outside element. And what we're calling the truth-telling and reconciliation piece of this, in which we work with both sides to help them see, first of all, that these ideas aren't true. The cops aren't fundamentally racist and the neighborhoods aren't fundamentally corrupt. That's wrong. But also the way in which, because both sides are acting as, you know, in those ways, they are driving the other side into a bad place. And that is work that is going on all over the country, and it is magical.
David Kennedy, I first of all, thank you so much for taking this hour with us. We look forward to having you back on the air with us to talk with our community more and in real interaction. Thank you for your work, and thank you for this book, Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship of the End of Violence in Inner City America. It's good to have you on the air with us once
and
again.
Thanks for staying on the case, Mark.
I will. Thanks, David.
I know.